Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. And as a reminder, this program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's program, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Mary, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect program, Treatment Updates for Cutaneous T-Cell Lymphoma, Multidisciplinary Care. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and 15 other organizations, and I would particularly like to acknowledge the Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation and the Lymphoma Research Foundation, both of whom have been particularly instrumental in making this program possible. We'll be saying more about that during the program. Now, it's because of this collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. And we have on our call today over 552 people on this call today. And that's really a large number of people. It's probably our largest number on these programs, on the cutaneous T-cell lymphoma updates that we've done. So it's a credit to each of you that you've joined us. You come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities. You also come from rural and suburban areas. And you also come from frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada and Egypt. So you really come from all over the world. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers have prepared. And there also is information about all of the different organizations that have worked to make this program possible. And there is also an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. Who but each of you can best tell us what you would like us to provide, what topics, how you'd like us to address them? And so we very much appreciate your feedback. So please take a moment and let us know what you think of the program and let us know what your recommendations are. Now, this program today is supported by an unrestricted educational grant to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Merck Oncology. And I really want to thank them for supporting this very important program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want you all to sit back and to listen to these just wonderful presenters. And our first presenter is Dr. Pierluigi Porcu. And Dr. Porcu is Associate Professor of Medicine at the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Porcu is going to address an overview and diagnosis of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. He's also going to talk about the importance of working with dermatologists and oncologists to better manage your care. He's going to also address issues of symptom management as well. I'm now going to turn the program over to Dr. Porcu.
Thank you, Carolyn, welcome everybody on the call. It's great to be on this important call with Dr. Cooper, Dr. Geskin, Judy Jones, and Jen Mills from the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Carolyn and guests, my task today is to essentially provide an introduction to the diagnosis of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, and the way I would like to try to do that is to provide a narrative of what cutaneous T-cell lymphoma actually is and how it comes to be diagnosed. This is very important because as we talk about quality of life in symptom management, I am a strong believer that the quality of life and survivorship and symptom management begins with the first visit between the patient, his or her family, and the specialist in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, be a dermatologist or a medical oncologist. And as I see patients in my clinic, I know that the shock is great when a patient is find himself or herself from an initial skin biopsy, which was done because of a diagnosis of a simple rash, in the chair in the office with a medical oncologist or a specialist dermatologist in this disease and is told that, that he or she actually has a malignancy. That is really a shock. And as I do the consultation, I know that a great amount of time on the first visit is really spent in trying to explain to the patient and their families what exactly this cutaneous T-cell lymphoma is. And I hope to be able to accomplish that in the first few minutes. So what I like to do is first to start breaking down bit by bit this alphabet soup or acronym of CTCL. And cutaneous essentially means something that has to do with the skin. In regard to the disorders that we're discussing today, cutaneous generally means that the skin is the predominant site of involvement of this disease, or the only one. And the next word, lymphoma, that's the one that catches the attention during the conversation or during the phone call when you get a diagnosis. Many in the audience are aware that lymphomas are cancers of the lymphatic system, which is also known as the immune system. And when one of the components of the immune system becomes malignant, we call that lymphoma. We generally think about lymphoma as cancers causing uncontrolled growth of lymph nodes or spleen, occasionally liver, and frequently involving the bone marrow. So the first question that a lot of patients and their families ask are, how can a lymphoma actually develop in the skin? The immune system is made up by a network of small vessels and relay stations that we call lymph nodes, and by the cells that live in those stations and travel along those vessels. The primary function of the immune system is to recognize and fight off dangerous infectious agents, or keep in check infections that during the evolution have established themselves as our biological roommates, so to speak. For example, the bacteria that live normally in our guts, or some chronic viruses that we all catch during childhood or adolescence, and then they stay with us for the rest of our lives. Now, the territory that the immune system has to cover is vast, and this requires a very efficient surveillance operation. To do that, the immune system makes use of different agents, or in medical terms, of different types of cells. Some of these cells are called B cells, like boy. And we will not talk about them today, but they are an important cause of lymphoma in other types of lymphomas. Other cells are called T cells, like Tom, T like Tom. Now, T cells have been assigned the task of the on-the-field surveillance and patrol in the body. T cells are like the cops. I like to imagine them like that. The cops in the police car that spends their day roaming around making sure that the neighborhoods are safe. They spring into action if they see something bad happening. Now, I like to imagine B cells like the cops at the police station working at their desk, which in the case of the human body we call the lymph nodes. And both are needed. But I have to admit I have a special preference for the T cells that do the hard job. As T cells travel around, the hot spots or border zones are those organs where the human body is in constant contact with the environment. And these are the digestive system and the guts, which are open from one end to the other, and the respiratory system, because we continuously breathe air in and out. But if you think about it, the single largest area of contact and separation barrier between the body and the environment is the skin. So the skin is a very important part of the operation field for the T cells in their surveillance effort. In fact, the immune system has dedicated a specific squad, so to speak, of T cells that are designed to travel to the skin through the blood and the lymphatic vessels, provide surveillance in the skin, and then briefly return to the base, whichever that might be. And we don't have a definitive knowledge of that at this point, just to start another round of patrolling surveillance shortly after that. Now, when one of these T cells becomes malignant, that's when we develop CTCL, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Now, this also, the fact that these cells are occasionally traveling around in route explains also why sometimes we can find these cells in the blood using very sophisticated tools, even in patients who have absolutely no sign of disease outside of the skin. In those cases, what we're doing is we're catching these so-called skin-homing T cells in their journey to and from the skin. But that's where they ultimately program to go, in the skin, and that's why most patients have no evidence whatsoever of cancer outside of the skin. In a small minority of patients, after many years, the malignant T cells lose their specificity for the skin, and they start migrating into the lymph nodes and other organs. This generally is associated with a more aggressive course and requires more aggressive treatment, and this, I think, will be discussed further on in this call. Now, because even within the T-cell squad, so to speak, there is some division of labor, depending on exactly which type of skin-homing T-cells is hit by this malignant process, one will have a slightly different type of CTCL. Therefore, CTCL is a generic catch-all name that includes all T-cell lymphomas that affect primarily the skin. Now, the most common type of CTCL and the one that has been recognized for the longest time is called mycosis fungoides, a rather bizarre name that derives from the fact that the first few patients discovered to have this disease more than 100 years ago had large fungating tumors off their skin, and that is because this disease had not been recognized and there was no treatment for it. Now, that name stuck, and now we still call this specific type of CTCL mycosis fungoides. Now, this call, I believe, will be mostly dedicated to mycosis fungoides, but I believe that there may be chances to discuss other types of CTCL in the question and answer session. Now, mycosis fungoides is a rare disease, but one recent study has shown that there has been a significant increase in the number of new cases diagnosed each year over the past 15 years. This is a relatively recent paper that was published. Currently, we believe that mycosis fungoides represents about 4% of all cases of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. As a medical oncologist who's taking care of a variety of other patients with lymphoma, this 4% is not such a small number because other very important types of non-Hodgkin lymphomas, such as mantle cell lymphoma, that have dedicated focus, research, and so on, they are not more frequent than mycosis fungoides. We don't know why there has been an increase in the new cases diagnosed. It could be because perhaps MF is becoming more frequent, but might also be due to the fact that we have become better and better in diagnosing this disease, and we're diagnosing it at an earlier stage. I don't think anybody knows which of these two situations actually this is. Now, before I move to the next topic of how we make a diagnosis of mycosis fungoides, I'd like to mention Sézary syndrome. Now, Sézary syndrome is a variant of mycosis fungoides where the skin is completely red, and that is called erythroderma. Itching is extremely severe, lymph nodes are often enlarged, and the malignant T cells are found in the circulation. Sometimes even they can be visualized by doing a peripheral smear from the blood, sometimes in large numbers. Now, Sézary, in my view, is probably the closest thing to a medical emergency that one can find in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and requires prompt recognition because patients are quite ill, they lose a lot of heat through the skin, and they frequently can actually have a high risk of infections, and they need to be treated promptly. I believe that Dr. Getzkin may discuss some of the modalities of treatment for Sézary in specific during her discussion of photopheresis. So how do we make a diagnosis of mycosis fungoides, and why is it so difficult to make a diagnosis? Well, MF requires a skin biopsy. But not just that. It requires also a clinical presentation that is consistent with what we have expected and what we know from the history of the clinical presentation of mycosis fungoides. Now, itchy skin and skin rashes are very common, as most people know, and because skin biopsies are often not completely clear in terms of the appearance of the cells, particularly in early stages, it's not at all uncommon that patients go through multiple visits through doctors. It could be their family doctor or dermatologist, and even multiple skin biopsies before a diagnosis of MF is made. This is a very frustrating process, which I do understand. But I have to say that it is not uncommon that when we review the history of clinical visits and biopsies over the past, let's say, 3 or 4 years, we can see the difficulty that the other physicians had in actually making a right diagnosis. And just time gives finally a clear picture that allows us to recognize the disease. Now, there are a few things that people should know that are typical of MF. One is that the rash typically involves the trunk in so-called a swimming suit pattern, assuming that people are still using the old swimming suits from 100 years ago. But this is because the areas that are exposed to the sun tend to be less involved. And this makes sense because if you think about it, we're using ultraviolet therapy for the treatment of mycosis fungoides. So ultraviolet therapy by itself, even through sunlight, is effective. Now, the rash of mycosis fungoides is typically made of flat red patches and slightly thick scaly patches, plaques as well. Occasionally, there are some round, bumpy lesions that can be seen called tumors. These three types of skin lesions correspond to the different stages of skin disease in the staging system for mycosis fungoides, which we may be able to discuss in detail later. But briefly, essentially, the staging of mycosis fungoides includes less than 10% of patch and plaque disease, more than 10% of patch and plaque disease, the involvement of tumor lesions, the involvement of extranodal tissues and extracutaneous tissues, and the presence of erythroderma consistent with Sézary syndrome. Those are the basic stages of mycosis fungoides. Also, one has to consider that there are a number of variations in terms of the clinical presentation of MF, and the clinical presentation can be different. A variety of patients, for example, don't have any itching whatsoever, and therefore they may not be aware of the rash, and even if they become aware of the rash, the question of the quality of life and how that is affected by this, by the disease needs to be taken into account before a treatment about decision about treatment actually is made. Finally, I'd like to make a couple of comments as to who gets mycosis fungoides. And for the most part, MF is a disease that gets diagnosed later in life. And it also appears to be more frequent in African Americans compared to whites and Caucasians. Sometimes this leads to a confusing situation where one would expect that most patients with mycosis fungoides would be African American. This obviously is not the case, because even though the frequency of mycosis fungoides diagnosis in African Americans is higher, but there are many more patients of Caucasian and white ethnicity that are diagnosed with MF every year. Finally, the age. Although most patients with MF are diagnosed in advanced age, there are some cases of MF that are diagnosed in childhood sometimes, and frequently in their teens years or early 20s. There is not enough information right now on the natural history and the course and the biological differences between disease in youngs and in the elderly, but I think that's going to be an important area of research in the future. Finally, I'd like to just mention some questions that I believe every patient with a diagnosis of MF should ask their physicians when they go to for their consultation. First, what stage of disease do I have, and why is that important? The doctor should be able to explain to you what stage do you have and how he or she is going to use this stage to make decisions about treatment. What is the probability that my disease will progress to a more advanced stage? And generally, this is leads to a favorable response, because only a small minority of patients with MF actually gradually and relentlessly progresses to a more advanced stage. What test would the doctor recommend for the initial staging of the disease, and how would he use those tests to make decisions about treatment? For example, is a bone marrow biopsy necessary, or are CAT scans necessary? And we can discuss all of those perhaps in the question and answer session. Do I need treatment now? If yes, why? And if no, is that going to be detrimental to my health? So all those questions need to be asked. If we decide to go with treatment, what goals should we have as we embark on treatment? What are the realistic expectations about the outcome of treatment? What spectrum of available treatment is available to try to reach those goals? Finally, how do I know that the treatment is working or not working? Obviously, if somebody is having a lot of itching, the resolution of the itching is a very important sign, or even the resolution of the rash. But there are many patients who don't have itching. And then for those patients, we have to decide how we're going to decide whether the treatment is working or not. Finally, what changes should I make in my daily life? Diet, exercise, stress, reproduction, and so on. Those are all great, great questions. One of the things that people should know is that there is a slightly higher risk of developing other types of cancers in patients with MF compared to the average population. Therefore, I believe that good healthy habits should be extremely important in the daily life of patients with MF, such as don't smoke, good diet, exercise, and so on. I'd like to stop here, and I'd like to give the line back to Carolyn to move on with the next part of the program. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Very comprehensive overview of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, really doing an excellent presentation and giving us lots of things to think about, and those excellent questions at the end that people should really note and keep in mind. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Kevin Cooper. Dr. Cooper is professor and chair, Department of Dermatology, University Hospitals Case Medical Center, Case Western Reserve University, Cleveland VA Medical Center. And Dr. Cooper is going to really talk about the role of dermatologists in treating cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. He's also going to talk about some of the dermatologic treatments to better manage cutaneous T-cell lymphoma and something about symptom management. Dr. Cooper?
Yes, thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, Dr. Porcu, for that great introduction and description of the issues that everybody needs to face as they get diagnosed and try and move through the complexity of this. What I would like to do is approach this really from how I would explain this to you if you were a patient in the office. And because there are different treatments for different stages, we'll have to take it stage by stage as what the options would be. And of course, at this point, you would know at what your stage is, what your initial stage is. You may have already been treated, and you may either be worse or better than what your initial stage was. So sometimes we talk about current stage or maximum stage, so because you can be better or worse from how you were when you first presented. So I'll talk about that, and then also talk about what our goals of treatment are. So when we treat, how do we know if you're getting better, and is it worthwhile, that particular treatment for you? So, for instance, we would like, with any treatment, that you would live longer, live better, and that it would be safe, so that we don't, for instance, if we're talking about living better, the treatment may be making the disease go away by the doctor's assessment, but you may feel that the side effects are really not very pleasant, and you're itching more from the treatment than you were from the disease, and it's really not worth it, that particular treatment. So when we think about living better, we're taking into account not only is the disease getting better, and are you able to do the things that you like to do in a better way, but is the drug causing some limitations, or is the treatment causing some limitations for you? So the net effect of all that should be that you're living a little better. And of course, we don't want to do any harm or do as little harm as possible in relation to the benefit that you're getting. So we want to minimize the risk and maximize the benefit for you. So these are the things that, you know, I would have a discussion with you and that you should ask your doctor to talk about in terms of what are my benefits, what are the risks, what is the hassle factor of the therapy. So let's go ahead and start with stage 1A, which would be where you would have thin lesions on the skin with less than 10% of your body surface area involved. So at some point, people start up in that stage. You may not stay there very long. You might move to greater than 10% relatively quickly, or you might stay there for years. And so we would talk about therapies. Oftentimes, you're not even diagnosed for a long time, and you've been using topical corticosteroids that your primary care physician or your dermatologist or whoever's taking care of you has prescribed for that lesion, and that's okay. That actually is useful for control of early stage disease and can cause the lesions to regress, usually with minimum side effects of the cream. As the number of lesions get more and more, that becomes less and less practical. So when you break over from stage 1A to stage 1B, then creaming up on a regular basis becomes less practical and starts to take a bigger chunk of your time. Now, side effects of these topical steroids would generally be thinning of the skin or a causing of the skin to be quite red. Sometimes the skin can become irritated, but as it starts to thin, it can become very easily bruised, and the skin can become very fragile. And so that is a limitation for long-term use of the topical steroids. And usually, eventually, the lymphoma will break through, and it won't be controllable very well with the topical steroids anymore. But it's okay for them to be used in the early stages. And most patients will come, have already tried them at some point because it takes so long to get diagnosed. Now, another treatment, and when people come in with early stage disease, if you're lucky enough to be diagnosed and you only have one lesion, then it's possible to use radiation therapy for that when there is one lesion, and just radiate that one lesion, and sometimes it'll go away and stay away. But that's very unusual to catch it at such an early stage. Usually it takes many years to diagnose, as Dr. Porco mentioned. So then the another treatment that can be used for early stage disease is something called Bexarotene gel. It's also a topical preparation and can be used when you don't have too many areas to have to put it on. One of the considerations with this gel is it can be quite irritating, and sometimes it's hard for the patient to tell or for you to tell whether you've traded some benefit from that the lymphoma may actually be getting better, and the dermatologist might be saying, you know what, I think your lesions are looking better. It looks like there's less lymphoma here, but you may say, but wait, I'm still red and I'm still scaly. And the doctor may say, well, that's just retinoid dermatitis, because this is a kind of retinoid, and we know that this class of medications, when we put it on the skin, can cause redness and scaling. But from your point of view, you may have traded one kind of redness and scaling for another kind of redness and scaling. And so that's a limitation for that particular approach. But in some patients, it works very well, and their skin is tougher than other people's skin, and they tolerate it, and they do well with it, and it's useful for a while. Another treatment that can be used in the stage 1A stage when there aren't a lot of lesions is something called nitrogen mustard. And again, this can come in a gel or an ointment, or you can make it up as a liquid even. And this can also be used as a sort of spot treatment kind of approach, or it can be used to treat the entire body. But generally nowadays, I tend to use it more as a spot treatment kind of approach. And the side effects for this one are that it does cause some changes in the DNA of the cells in the skin, and so you can create some damage to the skin in the sense that it can cause a higher risk for skin cancer, just like ultraviolet radiation or other radiation can do. So it's very useful, generally well-tolerated. A few people can become allergic to it, like a poison ivy kind of reaction, in which case we usually stop it for a while, try and treat with some steroids to calm it down, and then maybe introduce it at a very, very low concentration. But usually at that point, it's hard to treat with it anymore. Now, as the lesions become more extensive, the creaming approach or the lotion or gel approach becomes less practical. And so then we'll usually start to talk about ultraviolet therapies. So here, there are three kinds of ultraviolet therapies that you may talk about depending on what kind of bulbs the dermatologist has in the office. So they can be what's called broadband UVB, narrowband UVB, or PUVA. PUVA. That's all in capital letters. And the basically the differences between these is that the broadband UVB tends to treat more, doesn't penetrate into the skin that deeply, whereas the PUVA penetrates into the skin the most deeply of the three, and the narrow band is kind of a happy medium. Each of these are in boxes, usually stand-up boxes, where the bulbs are over 6 feet in length. You walk into a box, it has a door, you open it up, you go down into just a minimum clothing, and then close the door behind you, and a technician turns the light on, and it exposes your skin to the ultraviolet rays. And usually, because, as Dr. Porcu mentioned, many of the lesions are in the sun-exposed areas. These are also areas in the sun-protected areas, these are also the areas that where your arm hangs down over your armpit. But that's an area where we often have lesions. So we'll usually ask you to raise your arm in the air, maybe turn, try and move around, so that those areas are getting exposed to the bulbs. The same thing if there are lesions on the inner part of the thigh, we'll ask you to try and move around inside the box in order to get those inner thighs exposed. Otherwise, we'll clear up everything else and leave these spots in these difficult to treat areas. Now, what are the side effects of these three? So generally, as you know, ultraviolet exposure can cause premature aging of the skin, can cause precancerous lesions called actinic keratoses, and can cause freckling that is associated with sun damage as well, and can cause skin cancers. The PUVA may have a risk for melanoma as well, but that risk is not proven for phototherapies with the UVB as of yet. In style, some physicians prefer the PUVA. For instance, in Europe, almost exclusively PUVA is used, whereas in the United States, the narrow band and the broad band tend to be used a little bit more. In general, if we know on the biopsy that there is deep disease, you know, that there is evidence of disease that is deep into the dermis, almost to the fat, then using the broadband UVB is probably not going to work. So there would be some considerations given here. Another consideration is whether or not you've had skin cancer in the past. So for instance, if you tell me that your father and your grandfather and your brother and your sister have all had melanoma, I'm going to be very reluctant to recommend phototherapy with any of the three to you. Another issue might be, or if you've had yourself a skin cancer in the past, a melanoma or a basal cell carcinoma or a squamous cell carcinoma, another consideration would be where is the closest box where you can get this treatment, and you may live too far away. It's not going to be practical to drive 45 minutes three times a week for 3 months to get this kind of therapy, or your schedule doesn't permit it. Your job doesn't let you out, even if it is right around the corner. So these would be considerations that we'd have to discuss, and it just may not work, even though it might be medically okay. If it doesn't work into your schedule and your life, there may be another choice that will work just as well and be more compatible with your going on with things. Now, if you're not responding to these things, or if you recur with disease, sometimes that's actually not so easy to tell, and so we may need to do a biopsy to determine, are you having a good response? That is, are you completely clear? Or is there still some disease in your skin, but we can't quite tell because the pigmentation is still there, or there's some redness and scale that's a side effect of the treatment, say from the ultraviolet or from the retinoid gel or from the mustard. So we may have to do biopsies not only at the beginning, but also to determine, are you relapsing, are you not responding, are you responding? So if there is recurrence, which there usually is at some point, we can combine things. So we can combine, for instance, the ultraviolet treatments with systemic treatments. For instance, we can combine it with treatments such as an oral retinoid, such as bixarotene or acitretin, or we can combine it with an injection called interferon, which is a hormone that can be used that has, it's an immunologic hormone that can be used and has some activity in cutaneous lymphoma. Moving on to other treatments, oral treatments that we have that are indicated in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma are oral bixarotene and oral vorinostat. So these agents are taken by mouth, as indicated there, and each have their own sort of side effects and benefits. In terms of their response rates, they're grossly similar. You don't know if you're going to be one of the ones to respond. It's not a guarantee. And so so it's a matter of determining what kind of medical history do you have. If you have evidence of bad heart disease, or if you have evidence of high lipids or kidney trouble or liver trouble, that may affect the choice of the benefit versus risk for you in that situation. In general, you can move from one to the other, but we don't have any evidence of what happens when you combine the two together. But these are both very useful at the point where you've moved into the stage 1B, 2A area, and you've had some experience with these other treatments and now need something to help control beyond the ultraviolet and the topical agents. Now, there's another therapy that can be used called electron beam therapy that you'll probably have read about. And this is where these are kind of what are called sort of soft X-rays. That is, you go to a radiation therapist, and the radiation therapist has machines that deliver these electrons that penetrate into the skin about to the subcutaneous fat, that is going through the leather layer of your skin just to the fat cells. And this can be very useful in a situation where tumors are starting to arise and they're in various locations and things are just not responding to these other approaches. The radiation oncologist can also spot treat, that is, if there's one tumor popping up or another tumor popping up, and treat just those tumors. And so that's another way to work. And you can see that you need to have good communication between the various therapists. I'm not going to go into the photophoresis because Dr. Geskin will go into that. And I'll also leave the systemic injectable agents and chemotherapy agents and the denileukin diftitox to Dr. Porcu in the question and answer portion of it, because this will affect a lower percentage of patients. So just in summary then, we're looking to treat and maintain quality of life. We know that the disease itself causes problems with emotional well-being, anger, sadness, depression, embarrassment, frustration, worrying about the disease worsening, worrying about whether this is going to progress into a more aggressive form. And so these are things that we know affect our patients, and we want to address those and have those things get better as well as the objective measurements. And so as we treat, we need to be not only looking at is your disease going away, but are your emotional needs also being addressed, and are you feeling that overall this is a good approach for you? So I'll stop there and turn it over to Carolyn and Dr. Geskin.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Cooper, for a very comprehensive, really excellent presentation, really identifying many of the dermatologic treatments that are available to our participants. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Dr. Larissa Geskin. Dr. Geskin is Assistant Professor of Dermatology, Director of Cutaneous Oncology and Photophoresis Center. She's an Associate Director, Dermatology Residency Program, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And Dr. Geskin is going to address actually an overview of photophoresis and how photophoresis is used to treat cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. She's also going to talk about managing symptoms to improve your quality of life. Dr. Geskin.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and I would like to thank Cancer Care and Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation and Lymphoma Research Foundation for organizing this wonderful session, and I think it will greatly benefit our patients. Thank you very much. I would like also thank Judy Jones and Jen Mills and Dr. Porcu and Dr. Cooper for providing insights into this disease for our patients. I will go over photophoresis and quality of life and symptom management very briefly to leave enough time for the questions. But again, as you've just heard from Dr. Porcu and Dr. Cooper, light therapy is something that we know is very helpful for patients with early stage diseases, and it's very effective for patients who have patch and plaque disease. But we know that in patients who have red skin all over or erythroderma, light therapy may not be as effective. And light therapy, PUVA therapy specifically, has number of side effects, as Dr. Cooper just outlined, including risk of skin cancers and other problems. And so some CTCL specialists in 1970s and early 1980s kind of got together and decided to see what's going to happen if you expose patients' blood in patients who have erythroderma or red skin with some blood involvement that they could see at that time to PUVA outside the body. So they would take white blood cells from the, they would put the needle in a patient's vein and would take out some white blood cells and expose those white blood cells to the PUVA light. And what they saw is that these patients also benefited from this type of therapy. And in 1988, FDA approved this type of therapy that we now called photopheresis for treatment of patients with CTCL. What's interesting now, and I think Dr. Porcu mentioned it, that even in early stage diseases, we sometimes find those malignant cells, they their numbers are very, very low, and so with conventional methods and with old methods, we couldn't see them. But now we can detect very small amounts of those cells even in patients with early stage diseases. And what's interesting now is that we think maybe this therapy may even work for early stage diseases. And in fact, there is a clinical trial is being conducted now looking at this specific issue, whether photopheresis is effective in patients with early stage diseases. But what exactly is photopheresis and how it is done? Usually patients come in once a month and get two treatments administered back-to-back, 2 days in a row, usually once a month. Sometimes they require accelerated treatment. In other words, they may require two back-to-back treatments, maybe once in 2 weeks or even more, depending on how their disease is and how they feel. So we use usually peripheral vein, peripheral access to access patients' blood. Sometimes, however, it's a problem and we need to put a central line or a port for patients to access their blood. It is less preferred, especially in patients who are erythrodermic, because of very high risk of infection when we insert central venous catheter. So by far, we prefer to use peripheral vein. It's a usual vein that we use when we draw blood. And so when patients come, the cannula is inserted into the vein, and the blood is drawn in a special machine where white blood cell fraction is separated from the red blood cells. Red blood cells are returned back to the patients, and white blood cells are irradiated in a special machine, what we called a special chamber, where we add sorolin. It's a photosensitizing agent, and then we irradiate this particular portion of the blood with UVA lamps. And then this blood is returned back to the patient. We are not sure exactly how it works because what gets irradiated is only a very small proportion of patient's blood. It's about 5% of total blood that is circulating in the body. So it's initially it was thought to be that PUVA light, when irradiated to white blood cells, which are your immune cells that contain malignant cells and many other good immune cells, such as dendritic cells. Those dendritic cells are the cells that may teach your immune system to fight off cancer, to fight off infections. And so what we think may be happening is not just killing of malignant cells, but also stimulation of dendritic cells, stimulation of your immune cells to fight off your cancer. And so the way how photopheresis works may be by immune mechanisms and not necessarily by simple killing the malignant cells in patients' blood. And so this procedure is rather safe, and one unpleasant portion of it is the needle that goes into the vein of the patient. But other than that, it is very well tolerated. Patients come in, and it lasts about 3.5 hours with the current instrument, and after that, they usually don't have significant side effects, and usually it is a procedure that is well tolerated. We can access wide range of patients, from very small patients up to 40 kilograms, which is about 80 pounds, to other patient sizes. So we even can do it in children But that has to be done in a very well-established unit by very skilled nurses, but that can be done. So efficiency of photopheresis was found to be significant. For a therapy that has very minimal side effects, the efficiency across the board through many, many studies, and there was a big literature review on photopheresis efficiency done in over 400 patients, and it was found that overall response rate for all stages of CTCL was over 50%, with about almost 20% complete responders. In other words, patients had such a significant responses that their skin almost entirely cleared and their blood cleared. So this is a very effective therapy for patients, and for those who, for whom it's not 100% effective, or for whom it's not quite getting them where they want to be, we can add other agents such as interferon. And Dr. Cooper mentioned interferon is an immune modulating agent, immune stimulating agent, that also is very effective when added to photopheresis treatment. The retinoids may be also added to photopheresis treatment to improve its efficiency. And bexarotene is one of the drugs that we use, but other ones can also be used to improve the efficiency of photopheresis. In terms of management of symptoms and quality of life improvement, I think photopheresis is probably one of the most convenient methods of and one of the best treatments we have for CTCL, especially in advanced stages that may improve quality of life with a low risk to benefit ratio. In other words, it has low risks and potential for very high benefit in selected patients. We can combine it with many different agents, as I mentioned, with retinoids, with interferon. We can also combine it with a new agent that was recently approved, vorinostat, that was also mentioned during Dr. Cooper's presentation. And by combining several agents together, we may achieve better response than by using photopheresis alone. Now, the topical therapies or skin-directed therapies that usually are not very effective in patients with advanced disease still play some role in management, and patients who have severe itching, they may have some relief from using triamcinolone or other topical steroids on an as-needed basis. The main problem, main quality of life issue for my patients is itching and sometimes pain, hands and feet cracks and things like that, and I find that using topical steroids or other skin-directed therapies in combination with photopheresis may be beneficial for my patients, including, as I mentioned, triamcinolone or even stronger steroids, including combination of light therapy and photopheresis and other means. But because we all strive to induce long remission, sometimes we have to use several combined treatments together with photopheresis to achieve this effect. And with that, I would like to conclude and leave the rest for the question and answers session. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Geskin, for again an excellent presentation and really highlighting the important role of photopheresis in the treatment of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Thank you. We have two speakers before we take questions. I'm going to introduce our first one, Judy Jones, who's president of the Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation, who's been very instrumental in today's program in helping us to select the best speakers and to actually reach all of you. So I'm going to turn the program over to Judy Jones.
The Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation is the only organization that concentrates specifically on cutaneous lymphomas. Please take time to go to our website at www.clfoundation.org to find more information about these diseases. You will also be able to sign up for our newsletter, as well as find information on educational programs, support and assistance, publications to order, and clinical trials. We are currently in the process of adding information to our website, specifically for young adults in their 20s and 30s. This will include video podcasts and target issues for this age group. We are also translating some of the treatment information into Spanish. We hope to have both of these programs on the website within the next month. It's exciting to have so many people on this call, which wouldn't have been possible without the collaboration between Cancer Care, the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and the Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation. I hope you have learned from this call that we, as individual patients, are not alone. You also need to know that there are dedicated physicians and researchers working on improving treatments and working toward a better understanding of our disease. Thank you all for coming. And I'll toss that back to you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you, Judy, for being the great inspiration for actually these programs, actually, and for the foundation and all of your work. Thank you. And our next speaker is Jennifer Mills, Jen Mills. Jen is an oncology social worker. She's National Director of Patient Programs, Lymphoma Research Foundation. Jen also has been instrumental in this program and also instrumental in supporting the program and obtaining support for it. So I now want to turn the program over to Jen Mills.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest lymphoma-focused voluntary health organization dedicated exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing services and services for patients, survivors, and loved ones. We recognize that individuals diagnosed with lymphoma want information on their specific form of the disease and relevant treatment options. To meet these needs, we offer a wide range of programs and services. These include our Lymphoma Helpline and Clinical Trials Information Service, where trained public health and mental health professionals are available to answer your questions and help you find clinical trials in your area. The search for treatment information, including clinical trials, can be complex and overwhelming. We encourage you not to struggle on your own and to call us for help for easier access to information that's created on a patient-friendly level and reviewed by lymphoma experts. We also offer, in addition to our clinical trials helpline and information service, publications which include fact sheets, booklets on non-Hodgkin lymphoma and Hodgkin lymphoma, a quarterly newsletter, and we also have, that's been very interesting for patients, a new tip sheet on common terms of lymphoma that can help you decipher some of the terms that you've heard on the call today that might be confusing for you. LRF's unique programs also include our in-person education programs where you're able to come and meet other people with lymphoma and learn from the world's leading experts on specific forms of the disease and specific treatment options. One in particular that I'd like to highlight is our North American Education Forum on Lymphoma. This is held in collaboration with the Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation, as well as numerous other organizations. It is a 2.5-day comprehensive program for patients, survivors, and loved ones that features over 25 lymphoma experts and patient support specialists from around the world. This program will be held in San Francisco, California, on September 26th to 28th. For more information on any of these programs or services, please call us on our 800 number at 800-500-9976 or visit us on the web at www.lymphoma.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jen, and thank you for those wonderful remarks. And now we have time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and let's see how many we can take. Mary?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Ben.
Yes. Will you please characterize what do you mean by lesions? It's not clear if it's when the skin breaks or not. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. Dr. Porcu, could you address that question?
Absolutely. So lesion is a very generic term that indicates any abnormality that can be visually observed in the skin. So it could be an area of rash, it could be a thick plaque in the skin, can be a nodule or a tumor. So it's as generic as it gets, and we use it just to indicate that there is something wrong in the skin. Also, it doesn't have to be specific for cancer. It could be any abnormality of the skin that is related to another type of inflammatory skin disease. It's just something that is used in a generic way. I hope this answered the question.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sally Ann.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I wanted to know if anyone was aware of any particular implications of CTCL in a post-solid organ transplant patient. Are there any special considerations, any changes in prognosis, treatment approaches, that sort of thing?
Dr. Porcu, could you address that in general?
Of course. This is a great question. It's a very specific subject, of course, but it is not an uncommon problem, particularly in medical oncology or physicians who are seeing patients developing cancer after organ transplantation. We generally define any type of lymphoma developing after a organ transplant or a bone marrow transplant as post-transplant lymphoma, and these are unique type of diseases in the sense that many times are directly related to the immunosuppressive drugs that people have to take to prevent rejection of the organs or to prevent the complications from bone marrow transplant, and certainly CTCL is a relatively rare but well-described type of post-transplant lymphoma. There's not a whole lot of published papers specifically dedicated to CTCL after solid organ transplantation. However, just from our personal experience here at Ohio State, as well as from other big centers who see patients with lymphoma after organ transplant, I have to say that our experience is consistent with a indolent course of these diseases, and they do not appear to have any different outcome compared to CTCL diagnosed outside of the field of organ transplantation. I think that perhaps the most important thing to consider is that this holds true if the diagnosis is mycosis fungoides. As I pointed out at the beginning, there are a variety of other types of cutaneous T-cell lymphomas that may not have a good prognosis as mycosis fungoides, and I think if we are discussing about those after solid organ transplant or bone marrow transplant, then the prognosis might be different.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Stephanie.
Yes, I was wondering, can anyone give me a name of any specific drugs that are currently being researched to achieve a cure for CTCL?
Excellent question. Dr. Porcu?
Well, I think it's always difficult to anticipate a curative effect of a drug that is in development. So the answer in short is no. There certainly are a variety of very interesting and exciting new drugs that are in development, and they appear to be very promising, but they have to go through testing, and they have to be tested in the sense of deciding exactly what degree of responses and what quality of responses. In terms of specific names, there are at least four or five different drugs that are relatively advanced in their development, and they are likely to come to the market. One of them is called romidepsin, I can spell it for you. It's R-O-M-I-D-E-P-S-I-N. Another one has an abbreviation and is called LBH-589. There are other drugs that are in development as well, but I think the important thing to remember is that each one of these drugs will have to go through extensive testing before having its worth really evaluated in a serious way. But these are some of the drugs that are becoming available. Another one is called PXD101. So they still don't have a full commercial name.
This is Dr. Cooper. I would say that the drugs that are coming through have somewhat different philosophies, and so some of them are designed to interfere with cells that proliferate, and in particular, target the T cells that proliferate. And so the more specific that they can be targeted against the T cells and not interfere with other cells of the body, the hopefully the better response that would occur with the least toxicity. And another philosophy is to kind of boost up the immune system to try and get the good side of the immune system to act against the malignant T cells. And so in that situation, you kind of harness the body's own natural immune system to kind of do the job that it really should be doing already. And unfortunately, sometimes with that, we don't control the immune system that well, and we can sort of unleash a dermatitis or an attack against other parts of the body. And so it's a balancing act. So there is a lot of excitement in the area about the new medications that are coming along. But as Dr. Porcu said, until you've seen the whole process of testing and safety testing and efficacy testing and going through the FDA process, we don't know exactly where each of these will fit in. But I think it's a very good time in the world of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Kendall.
Yes, my question was, when Dr. Gaskin was talking, she mentioned something about photopheresis showing promises and that it's convenient in the method for CTCL and low risk potential in selected patients. What are the criteria to be considered for patients to be considered for patients to be a candidate for photopheresis?
Excellent question. Dr. Gaskin, could you address that?
Sure. Well, currently, and I think historically, photopheresis was most frequently used in patients with erythroderma, in other words, in patients who had red skin all over. However, now we are part of a study that looking into efficiency of photopheresis in patients with early disease, and it seems that those patients are responding to photopheresis as well. As Dr. Porcu mentioned, that these patients with early disease may also have some circulating malignant cells at very low level, and they may require this immune modulation that we can induce by using photopheresis. So answer broadly, photopheresis may be used in a variety of different patients with the extensive patch plaque disease with the erythroderma, but maybe even in patients with earlier stage diseases as well. I don't think it's particularly effective in patients with tumor stage. Again, that is just not clear that by itself it may not be effective, but it may be effective if you combine photopheresis with some other modality such as electron beam or retinoids or some other treatment modality that may be used for patients with a small number of tumors, maybe one or two tumors. There is no cookbook recipe that I can give you that photopheresis should be used in this particular subset of patients. I think it may be used depending on your physician's choice for a number of patients with a variety of stages, probably from 1B, which is extensive patches and plaques, to stage 4A, even for patients who have erythroderma and maybe some leukemic component, in other words, malignant cells in the blood, and even with patients who have some lymph node disease, it may be effective in combination with other agents.
An excellent question to actually to take this information back to your treating healthcare team with information you've learned today and to ask about the appropriateness of this treatment for you in terms of your particular needs. So that's an excellent question. Thank you. And Dr. Gaskin, thank you for that excellent answer. I want to thank our speakers today. You've been really outstanding. This has been a remarkable call, actually. We've covered a lot of material. I know we could continue all afternoon. I know there's a great deal of energy and interest in this topic, and we hope to be able to offer more programs on this topic. I want to thank our speakers. I want to also thank all of you who have asked questions. I know you ask the questions to get answers to your particular questions, but in answering the question, in answering your question, it gives our speakers a chance to really expand further on the topic, and everybody learns from it. So I want to thank you for asking those questions. I know there are many more of you in queue, and I know you have other questions that you want to be asked. So this is a one-hour education program, and that when we plan this, we recognize that all of you would have many needs that would go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. So I'd like to just remind all of you that you do have access to the Cutaneous Lymphoma Foundation, to the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and to Cancer Care. And that so although we are going to conclude our program shortly, you have all of our information to contact all the organizations for help with answers to your questions. I'd like to say a few words about Cancer Care before we conclude. Cancer Care is an organization that provides support to people living with cancer. We have a staff of 40 master's level trained oncology social workers. We provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to counseling support to support groups, to telephone and online support groups, and to also just a chance to talk with somebody about some of your concerns and questions. So that between all of these three organizations, we do not want anyone to feel, as the program concludes, that you're alone in trying to cope with your concerns or issues. Please call us. We all have 800 numbers and websites, but do call us. This is a telephone education workshop, so you may have a question you want to ask someone right away. Don't hesitate to call us, and we're happy to answer your questions. Most importantly, perhaps our very important takeaway message for all of you is that you're not alone. You are part of a large community of support, of resources, and people who wish to help you. You also have all of our resource information in your materials. Please keep that. Hold on to us. Call us as you need to. And don't worry about calling us too often. We're here to help you, and that's really what we're all here for. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the program. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.